Good afternoon, everyone, or good evening, depending on where you are. What a pleasure it is to talk to Kathy Reichs. We've been doing this for, Lord, how many books now? Is this 22?
22. Mm-hmm.
So for 21 books, because we didn't actually talk in Kathy's first book, Deja Dead, which I can remind you won the Arthur Ellis Award in Canada for Best Debut Novel.
And but we may have talked when the virals came out.
We might have. Anyway, all these years, live, virtual, whatever it is, here we are. I have to say that I really loved the different places in Bonehackers. You know, this series goes back and forth from Tempe's life in Charlotte and her work to Montreal. And this one goes to Montreal, but then it goes off to a new place. But what I wanted to say first, aside from the fact that we do have some autographed copies from Kathy left to sign, is how gorgeous the cover is. I mean, look at that.
It's a good one.
It really is. Do you think it's inspired in part by the sort of Turks and Caicos vibe?
Yes, and by me, because when I first got the first version, it was like pine forest, and it looked like you were in northern Minnesota or something. And I said, you know, let's make this look a little more tropical. So that's what they came up with.
I know. Can you show us the British cover? You just showed it to me, but I think it's interesting how the colors, at least, are so similar this time.
Yeah. Yeah, although this is much less tropical island-ish.
It is, right. But the green is kind of, you know, it's fun when I do the, we do these e-invitations to people to make sure that they're focused on watching the event. And you can change the colors in the backgrounds and so forth, which I've gradually learned how to do. And then Rob has thrown me off MailChimp into some new program I won't know how to do. But I really played a lot with this one to try to get, you know, a background color that was going to be like this with white type. It was a challenge, but gorgeous.
Good, good.
Anyway, Montreal. Been there. Tempe, obviously, spent a lot of time there. But I don't remember ever actually being out on the St. Lawrence in a storm. Is that something that you've experienced yourself?
Well, no, not precisely. But she didn't plan to go out in a storm either. The storm just came up. It was a microburst, and it just came out of nowhere, and it was wild. So they're out there in this little boat, and there's thunder and there's lightning, and there's a guy up on the bridge because they're watching the fireworks. They have the International Festival of Fireworks every year throughout the month of June, I think it is. So that's a great place to watch the fireworks, except if there's a thunderstorm. So this guy's up there watching them, and seemingly he is struck by lightning, falls off the bridge, which is a big fall, into the St. Lawrence River. So the next day, Tempe is asked to go and try to recover his remains from the river, which she does. And she finds he has a tattoo. And that tattoo, there's an FBI database of tattoos. So she has somebody run. Yeah. Mm-hmm. She has the tattoo run through the database, and it links to a gang in the Turks and Caicos Islands down in the Caribbean. So she phones down there. And a detective is determined to come to Montreal. And Tempe keeps saying, you don't have to do that. We can ship the body down. Sorry, down there. But this detective is insistent. Turns out she has ulterior motives. She wants to talk Tempe into going to the Turks and Caicos to help with a would-be, a seeming serial murder killer who's killing young male tourists and hacking off their hands. But as the FBI becomes involved, it becomes clear that there's also cyber crime going on, and there's hacking going on into Wi-Fi systems and internet systems. So you see what I've done there with the hacking and the hacking into the cyber crime. So it's a double entendre.
It's actually a very complicated plot, and it's extremely difficult to see where it's going. There's one moment in which Tempe gets lost, and I thought that that might be a thread that you would never actually pull. But in the end, we did find out what happened. But that's too early. Let's go back to the image of, you know, they're out in the on the fleuve, the big St. Lawrence, in a small boat, and the engine quits. And so not a happy circumstance. And I wondered when I read that if you were setting up, you know, further nautical stuff. And it turns out that you are, because there is a really horrible boat thing that happens when they're in Turks and Caicos. Does it spoil anything to kind of describe what happens? That's one of the elements she has to deal with.
Yeah, because what happens is a boat, it's like the coyotes that we have here in the U.S. The Turks and Caicos are kind of a transit point for people, largely Haitians, trying to get out of Haiti and get to other points in the Caribbean or into the southern United States. And sometimes they're just abandoned. They die in these boats, and these boats have floated ashore, not just in the Turks and Caicos, but in other islands as well, with just corpses, dead bodies that are on board. So that happens while she's down there. These things always happen to Tempe. And so, of course, the detective asks her to help, you know, in sorting that whole mess out.
I thought it was nice the way you mirrored what happens in Turks and Caicos with that brief scene on the St. Lawrence. I don't remember that Tempe has done a lot of, you know, water body recovery. She's done all kinds of interesting recoveries over time, but is drowning been a big part of it?
Not really. There was one book, I can't remember which one, where a body washed ashore in a barrel.
Right.
Floated ashore in a barrel. But I don't know that we've done drowning, and we have not done, I have not done lightning. So it was interesting looking into what impact lightning might have on the skeleton, on bones.
So you obviously then had to turn to research, which you're so good at, rather than personal experience.
Yes, yes. I have not worked on a lightning victim that I know of.
You know, with all the weird storms going on, I wonder if there will be a rise in the number of lightning victims just because the weather is so bizarre.
Maybe. We had a good one down here the other day. My son's dog came wandering through and he had this big, thunder coat thing that they put on dogs to calm.
Oh, a thunder shirt. Yes, exactly. To calm them, right? It hugs them and it keeps them from being quite so nervous. Highly recommended for fireworks days like 4th of July.
Yes.
To keep them from, you know, leaping tall fences at a single bound.
Yes.
So he was wearing a thunder shirt to keep him calm during the storm?
During the storm, yes.
Yeah, we have two thunder shirts because we had a very nervous dog, but apparently our current puppies are completely indifferent to the weather. They go out and frolic around.
Yeah, I have a puppy also. I'm insane. I don't know what I was thinking, but I have a puppy and he couldn't care less about thunder.
Hmm. Well, all right. So so what's going on with Ryan? You know, this over the long course of this series, Tempe has had a kind of her personal life has evolved. She used to have something of a problem with alcohol, but she appears to have that under control. And, you know, I mean, mostly the books are focused on forensics and investigations, but Tempe has a sister, she has a personal life. This one seems to me, you know, it's pretty rich in her personal life as well.
Yes, by long distance, largely, because she talks with her sister, Harry. Talks with Ryan, but they're not there. They're not physically present in the islands. Well, throughout the story, they're not. But I did want to bring them in. I've introduced readers to her mother, who's quite computer savvy. Who else? Anyway, so she does. She has her daughter, of course, but her daughter's not in this book, except briefly at the beginning, maybe. Yeah. Maybe. So
her daughter seems to show up more in Charlotte. When it's the Charlotte Tempe.
Daughter.
But yeah. Ryan, you know, for a long time, Ryan was in Montreal and Tempe had a different life in Charlotte. But now they've been working at having some sort of relationship. And oddly enough, they've been thinking, or they each had a different vision of a vacation, as I remember for this book.
Correct.
Which you solved in an interesting way towards the end.
That's true. He's thinking hiking and mountains and she's thinking beaches and bikinis. So they ended up not getting the vacation at all.
Well, have you been to Turks and Caicos? It was hard for me to imagine you could have written this book without personal experience.
I never write about a place I haven't been. If I haven't been there already, I go there specifically to research Israel, Guatemala, Northwest Territories, Afghanistan. You know, if I've gone there, I mean, if Tempe's there, I've gone there. I've been to the Turks and Caicos at least 4 times. My daughter got married there several years ago. So
that, you know about the resorts and all the rest of it, because I've never been there. I thought I'd been all over the Caribbean, but somehow For those who don't know where they are, can you locate Turks and Caicos for us?
They're south of the Bahamas. I can't. You have to get Google Maps or just, you know, Google.
It's kind of a little blip of islands. I mean, it's more than one. Hence Caicos. And it's British. It's actually part of Britain. Like, it's not U.S. territory. Although I thought it was interesting that the money, the monetary system in Turks and Caicos is the dollars, not the pounds.
No, that's true. A lot of places.
Well, I assume it's because of the tourist dollars.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Makes it so much easier. That's why Turks and Caicos are so easy to travel. They speak English. They use the dollar. You don't have to deal with any of those issues. It's a very tourist-friendly place to go. And that's why when these serial murders start happening, you know, the government is very concerned about that, because a serial killer is not good for tourism. So there's a lot of pressure being brought to bear on this Royal Turks and Caicos police force detective to get this wrapped up.
She's an interesting woman. So she does come up to Montreal, even though Tempe, you know, says she doesn't need to. And how does she persuade Tempe to go to Turks and Caicos? Because it really wasn't on her agenda.
It really wasn't. She just pushes all the right buttons. And, you know, these are young men and there are going to be more of them that are going to die. And if you don't come and, you know, help with this and catch this guy, you know, and that works. Plus, it's the Turks and Caicos. And I believe it was winter, wasn't it? So that's not a hard sell.
No, I think it's summer because they were out on the river with the fireworks. But
that's true. You're right.
Tempe has been thinking beach in regard to a vacation when she and Ryan have been discussing it. So I suppose that works. But, you know, Tempe, I mean, one of her dominant personality traits has always been curiosity. If you can really get her, you know, hooked, so to speak. She's perfectly willing to go. How easy is it for her to, you know, go to Montreal to work and then sort of just go off? Does her work go on hold? Do her cases? What happens when she, you know, leaves?
Yeah, the way mine worked, usually the people I would work on had been dead for a while. So there was no urgency, but she makes it clear. She talks to her boss, to LaManche, and he said, no, there's nothing right now. And you're a direct flight away. So go ahead. If we need you, we'll phone you and you can be back home within 3 hours.
So there's an actual nonstop from Montreal to Turks and Caicos?
Yeah. And wow, from Charlotte.
Mm-hmm. Canadian playground. Who knew? Right. No, I love that. I mean, I love Montreal. Rob and I are actually taking a cruise on the Great Lakes from Duluth to Toronto next month. It is actually our original tour for a cruise was from Moscow to St. Petersburg, but wisdom prevailed and we changed it to Duluth to Toronto. But then we thought we could take the train to Montreal and then we can take the train to Quebec. And, you know, spend a little extra time there. I don't remember. I've traveled across Western Canada by train from Vancouver, you know, up to Banff and Lake Louise, but never done Eastern Canada. So have you spent much time traveling on trains in Eastern Canada?
I have, not so much Eastern Canada, but I was the Via Rail, which is the national rail.
Right.
I was the spokesperson for Via Rail for 1 year. And as part of that, I rode the train from Vancouver to Toronto, which took four nights and five days. It's a long train ride. I loved it. I thought, I'm going to be so bored. I'm going to take my computer and I'm going to write and I'm going to take books to read. I never opened the computer. I don't think I even did any reading. I don't know what I did, but it was absolutely, totally engaging. And it was like a cruise ship. You'd go into the dining room and you'd meet people and then you'd agree to meet for dinner the next night, that sort of thing. I loved it. You had your own little berth with, you know, your bed and your bathroom right there in your own little private space. So I thought it was great.
I would love to. Dick Francis, I don't remember the title of the book, but one of Dick Francis's books was in fact a train trip all the way across Canada. And it was like a traveling country house murder with, you know, everybody on the train that were the suspects. I've always wanted to do it. So, but I'm going to miss the middle part, the Saskatchewan, you know, the prairie part. So,
you know, I thought that would be so boring. I knew it would be beautiful through the Rockies. But I thought the prairies would be, I don't know, they must have been fascinating because the time just flew.
I would love to do it. I do think that the I'm trying to remember what it's called, the Rocky Mountaineer, the trip from Vancouver to Banff and Lake Louise is just extraordinary. We booked it round trip because I had to end up in San Francisco to give a talk in San Francisco. And so we did it round trip. And I this is just me, but I didn't think starting in Banff and going to Vancouver was as thrilling as starting at Vancouver and rising up. You must have done it that way if you went from Vancouver.
That's an offshoot. Mine didn't go up to Lake Louise and Banff. It was a different. It was a different route. It's a southern route. There are spurs that go different places.
Well, I can highly recommend the Rocky Mountaineer. It's absolutely gorgeous. And I'd love to have continued it. I guess we'd have had to go down to Alberta and then head out. But anyway, I'm looking forward to it. Montreal to Quebec sounds absolutely fascinating. So yeah, what do you love about Montreal? You've obviously spent a lot of time there. I think bagels when I think Montreal, because for years the best bagel store in the whole world was in Montreal.
Okay. All right. It's over near Saint-Laurent Boulevard. Just the whole city. It's like Paris in North America. It's you know, Toronto tries to be New York, but Montreal strives to be Paris, and it's very cosmopolitan, and but it's bilingual. A lot of people won't admit they speak English, but they do probably, unless you get out into the countryside. It's just, I don't know, everything about it, the restaurants, the worldview. I worked there throughout the 90s when the whole secession issue was really hot topic. And when the referendum took place, and it was so close, it was like 0.1% of a point that they voted it down. I remember watching those returns come in, and it looked like it was going to pass, but that's because Montreal came in late. But that was a really interesting time to be there.
It was. We were in Quebec when all of that was going on for not terribly long, but I can remember. And then over in the Gaspé, where the French is really different. I mean, it's I don't know, the Quebecois language is different. It's much more regional, isn't it?
Well, it is. And they're not just the accent, but some of the terminology, some of the words for things are different also.
Yeah. So Montreal is actually an island, isn't it? Or there's a mountain, but isn't the city on an island?
Yes, Montreal Island, and the city's on the island of Montreal, and there is what they call the mountain, but it's like, I don't know, 600 feet tall or something. It's
right.
A small mountain.
And it has a great old town, too. It's a lot of fun to go there and walk around. Anyway, Central Train Station, trains, not going to spend any time in Montreal, sadly, but going on to Quebec, which is one of my favorite cities. I loved it. I don't know what's going on at the end of September, but something has booked out the Chateau Frontenac and other places in Quebec. So we're going to try something different in Old Town, but it should be great. Anyway, Tempe, your life was Montreal and Charlotte, your working life, or Montreal? And so was natural for you to decide that Tempe would follow that same sort of bifurcation?
Yes. When I created the character, when I wrote Deja Dead back in, I began it in 94. I was teaching University of North Carolina in Charlotte and commuting back and forth, doing all of the forensic anthropology for the province. So when I decided to create a protagonist, I figured it's easier to just base her on myself. So she's a forensic anthropologist. She goes back and forth between the Carolinas and Montreal. She works for the main medical legal lab up there. So a lot of those parallels are based on me.
How about the TV? Did they decide to stick with all that?
The Bones with Bones? Mm-hmm. Oh no, they stick with none of that. Bones was set. I knew that when I optioned the character, I knew there would be changes. The Tempe was younger. The character was more socially awkward. It was placed at the Jeffersonian Institution, which is fictional, based on the Smithsonian. Washington, D.C. was available because the West Wing was going off air, so nobody else was really set in Washington, plus Seeley Booth's FBI. So it had to be somewhere that the FBI would have a very active presence and the type of cases he'd be called in on.
That was a really busy time for you. I can remember you were writing books and you were writing scripts and still working. You know, your work ethic is truly astonishing. You know, do you still keep up that pace?
No, I'm retired from the university, finally. I was on sabbatical for something like 15 years. Mm-hmm. And then they said, you know what, maybe it's time you retire. So I did about 3 years ago. And I'm pretty much withdrawn from doing casework. I'm leaving that to my younger colleagues.
But, well, you know, is it physically taxing?
Oh, yeah, it is, especially if you have to go out to crime scenes to recover remains. Yeah, that's hard. Or, you know, doing autopsies, being in the lab, it's exciting. It's exhilarating. I love it. I loved it. And I miss it to some extent. But it's nice to be able to focus on the writing.
So that's basically your retirement project, is to keep on writing?
For now, I just signed a 2-book contract. So I'm working on book number 23, which will be out next year. It's Fire and Bones, and it will be set in Washington, D.C. Oh. I thought that would be interesting. So
in an election year. Yep. Wow, that will be interesting.
True, although, well, that's true. I should deal with that, shouldn't I?
Probably. No, I mean, I had a stray thought there. What was it? Hello. Oh, when you were over at another publisher, you wrote two books. Three.
Yeah, yeah.
That were not Tempe. And
one that was not Tempe.
Oh, okay. For some reason, I thought there was a second one with that character.
No, I did the whole viral series with my son. There's 6 of those.
Oh, I know, but I was thinking about the adult. I don't know why, that I absolutely thought for some reason that, anyway, I liked her. And I guess the question I've always thought about was, you know, whether you were going to do anything more with her, because I thought she was really interesting.
Yeah, she was. I'm creating a new character in the book. I'm in book 23. With the idea in mind that maybe I'll make her more of a major character in the next book.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. The Tana French does that. She'll introduce a character in one book and then make it the main character in the next book.
Well, you know, I think in a really long-running series, people get attached to characters, but at some point, it often happens at events we do for long-running series that people will ask if so-and-so is going to have their own book. Or, you know, play a bigger role.
Yeah.
It seems like a natural outgrowth. But I was also thinking, I probably shouldn't say this on this, but I'm going to do anyway. I want to congratulate you on going back to Scribner, because as this all turned out with the news of Simon & Schuster's purchase the other day, it was a very shrewd move on your part.
Well, little did I know that was going to happen. And we really didn't know who was going to buy Simon & Schuster until... You know,
no, I know you didn't do that, but you know, your books were for a really long time, and I thought it was great that you took them back, so to speak, back home again. And then as events have worked out, that was a good decision. Not one that you could have foreseen, but still it turned out well.
Yes, hopefully. We'll
yeah. See. No, I'm really pleased. I've talked to a couple of people about it. I was rooting for Simon & Schuster to be bought by a not publishing company. You know, a financial company. I mean, you should know, and I know, Kathy, that, you know, the financial part of publishing is bizarre at best. Doesn't really make sense. And I don't know whether being owned by KKR will introduce more financial sanity or whether they'll just leave everything alone. It's hard to know. But right. It could be that it might be, you know, kind of a refresher for major publishing to have... you have a financial company, you know, people used to money, kind of resetting things.
We'll see. One good thing I think for authors is we won't be thrown into a bag with all kinds of other authors, you know.
It's very true. Yeah. Right. And they also apparently have some sort of profit sharing idea, which means that the people who work there will get a stake, which I think, you know, will lead to long-term retention of good employees and so forth. And, you know, so all that works to an author's advantage as good. Well. But I thought I was really happy to see the result. Interestingly enough, all the testimony was about authors, and I kept wanting to say, wait, talk to me, because there were going to be ramifications for booksellers too. But yeah. Anyway, didn't have to happen. In the computer stuff in this, because you got some pretty serious tech stuff in this book, how good are you at that? Or is that something where you need to, you know, get some outside input?
Oh, I definitely needed outside input on that. That idea was triggered by an expose in the New York Times by Ronan Farrow and I forget his co-author about NSO and Pegasus, this very powerful spyware that many governments, it's developed in Israel. Right. Many governments have purchased it. The US government was considering purchasing it. It's the kind of spyware that can be put into your phone. It's a no click. So it's not like you have to click on something and accidentally get it downloaded. They can put it in your phone without you even knowing. And then it can be used to spy on individual citizens. So the government, the US government decided not to buy it in the long run. But when I read that story, that's what triggered the idea. I'm always trying to figure out, because it takes a year to write the book, a year to produce the book, what's going to be on people's minds 2 years in the future? And cyber hacking and personal security with your devices, that kind of thing should be of concern to everybody.
It certainly should. In fact, as we're seeing the ongoing drama on the political stage, I noticed today they subpoenaed Trump's Twitter account. What now called X, apparently.
X, yes.
Right, X. But the idea that anything electronic is private or can be erased or deleted. People yeah. really need to smarten up and recognize that I'm always surprised by, at this point, criminals who don't understand that if you're going out to be a criminal, you should leave your phone home. I mean, exactly. It's just yeah. amazing yeah. how people yeah. keep like convicting themselves, you know, by yeah. never letting go of their phone. And I'm beginning to think that it's so unconscious to have it that we all feel like undressed or naked. I actually went somewhere the other day in the car, I left my phone at home and I was sort of anxious, you
yes,
know?
No, I get it, yeah.
So I thought that the cyber parts of the book were really fascinating, but I don't want to do any spoilers here, but actually the part that gripped me the most was the boat of people who left Florida and eventually come to Tempe's attention. And I really didn't have any idea where you were going with that. I thought it was very well done, but also really awful to contemplate what happened to those people.
Yes. Yes, it's a scary thought. Scarier than being in the St. Lawrence River in a storm, being out in the ocean.
Yeah.
And no
well,
control.
I mean, yeah, I mean, I don't know that you can swim for sure in the St. Lawrence with any success, but at least you had some, you know, hope that you would maybe get rescued enough. The book is, I think I would describe it as ambitious. There's a lot going on in this book. And you have to, you know, it's so compelling you race through it, but you really have to pay attention to make sure that you keep up with everything. And kudos to Kathy, because she actually brings all of it together. Yay.
Thank you. Thank
you. Were you proud of it when you got done?
Yes. Well, when I finish it, I'm a very linear writer. I begin with chapter one, and I do chapter two, chapter three, chapter four, chapter five. My daughter is, if she's in a good mood, she writes the love scene. And if she's blue, she writes the death scene. And that's wrong. I can't do that. So when I do finish it, I print the whole thing out. And then I do the old fashioned, I do editing, I go through it on hard copy. And then I make, you know, all the changes, then I introduce those into the computer manuscript, and then I print it out again, and then I make all kinds of changes again. So it's a long, laborious process of editing that I do on each manuscript.
But editing, I mean, part of it, there's pacing and there's characterization and there's dialogue and all, but at some point you also have to make sure that every single thing that you put into the whole plot has some sort of resolution. I mean, you do, because you're a meticulous author. Some people don't bother, you know. Sometimes there are just like loose ends in some books.
Thriller readers are that way. Thriller readers are very astute. They'll, if you throw in a red herring, which is legitimate. You can do that, but you have to tie it off. You have to explain it, and you can't rely on coincidence. And they'll catch it if you don't explain it. Well, what about that, you know, that purple flower that she was wearing in chapter two? You know, why was that in there? So,
yeah. Did you read the Washington Post today about the woman who invited people to lunch and four of them died?
I did not.
Well, it's, I mean, they think that it reminds me of Dorothy Sayers, who got her mushroom science wrong in the only book that she wrote where people died by mushroom. They think, but they're not sure, that they were served. I'm trying to remember what the death mushroom is.
Where is this?
It's in Australia. Some woman in Australia.
In a restaurant.
I think it was in her own home. She invited her in-laws, one now dead, one in a coma, and two other people to lunch. And she served her children something else. So they were okay. But the four guests, three of them died, and one of them is in a coma and probably would live. I only mention it because it's a lead article in the Washington Post. And I thought you might have seen it, but it reminded me of one of the I'm trying to remember whatever it'll come to me. Dorothy Sayers, who was not as expert with poison as, say, Agatha Christie, or even Ellis Peters, who actually had served in pharmacology units during the wars. Anyway, Dorothy got the mushrooms wrong and never corrected it. But I thought, I think there's a hint that maybe this was intentional, or maybe nobody can work out whether it was accidental or whether it was intentional, where the mushrooms came from in the first place. And yeah, you know, yeah. I thought, so it occurred to me that if there's some version of you over there, wherever this is, that it might be kind of a challenging thing. But have you ever thought about, you know, that sort of challenge for Tempe? You know, somebody dies and nobody really can figure out why?
Well, I try to bring a different forensic science into every single book. And I don't think I've used forensic botany at all. It's possible. I can't remember what I did at all, you know.
Well, I know it's 22 books is a lot. But I guess one of my questions was, if you had, you know, Tempe digging up, well, of course, there could be enough of the body left. I didn't know whether, you know, mushroom poisoning is something that would last in the body long enough for Tempe to
probably even not, because if it kills that quickly, it's not certainly not going to get into the bones. Or right. The hair or the teeth. So right. That's not something Tempe would be involved in.
Well, I could see a plot where maybe people died like that, and in the process of that, you spaded up bones or something. I mean, there's a lot you could do with bones. I love
yes.
it.
Not yes. if the person dies right away. It's
right. Yeah. Yeah. Right. So why don't we bring Jacob up and see if any of your fans might have questions that this somewhat disjointed presentation by me. Sorry, but at this hour of the day, I tend to wander around.
It's 8 o'clock, also, right? I'm almost 9 o'clock. So.
Right. Well, one of the challenges is talking about a book this early when nobody's read it is some of the things you really would like the most to discuss, you can't. Right. And so you wind up dodging around or sort of going off into tangents because, right. you know, the...
no spoilers.
Yep, exactly. It would be really unkind to, you know, wreck the reading experience. So Jacob, any comments from the audience?
We have lots of comments, a few questions. Okay. There was a question about whether or not you still write with your son, Kathy.
No, we did the 5 virals books and then a collection called Trace Evidence, I think. And then he dumped me. He signed his own contract. He's now got out a series called The Dark Deep, which is middle grade. And he's done a series called Genesis, Crystallis, I think that series. And then he's got another one, which skews a little bit older. And now he's working on an adult book. He also just did a graphic novel, Lex, Kent and Lex. It's a graphic novel about the young Superman in his teens.
Wow. So do you think it's genetic, or was it just, you know,
he went to law school. He hated practicing law. He came to me and said, why don't we write a series of books together to get out of practicing law? So he's never looked back at the practice of law. My daughter is also a lawyer and she doesn't practice law.
Is she also an author?
She is. She writes contemporary women's fiction, and she's working on a psychological thriller right now. So
there was a question asking what her name was, her pen name.
Carrie Reichs, K-E-R-R-Y, Carrie Reichs and Brendan Reichs.
All right.
HarperCollins. I don't know who's publishing Brendan.
That seems to be all the questions that came up in the time.
Want to quote any of the comments?
There was a question about a location in Montreal, and they were wondering whether or not you've been. Habitat 67?
Habitat 67 was built for Expo 67. It was the architectural wonder of the time. It's on the shore of the St. Lawrence River, across from the old port. So when you're down in old Montreal, you see it across the water. And it's like cubes that are stacked up on, one on top of another for the different rooms that make up its condos now. But that's where athletes stayed during Expo 67.
I want to give a shout out to the Botanical Garden in Montreal. And if I remember right, it also has a really beautiful Japanese section and maybe a Japanese tea house. But it's a gorgeous botanical garden.
And they do a spectacular thing at night where they have all these Chinese lanterns that are lit up. I think that's at the Botanical Garden. It's in the winter, so I think at Christmas. So it's a little nippy, but.
Another question came up. This is from Dave Hickel. Do you foresee an end to your series, Kathy? I hope not.
Well, yeah, there's going to be an end at some point. I don't know when yet. I'm not ready to wrap her up yet. I'm working on book number 23 right now, so there will be at least one more book. Then we'll see.
You haven't really aged MP in real time. I mean, it isn't like she's shot into her 60s while you've been writing this. So, I think it really is just whether you decide you'd rather write another character or, something of the sort, but you haven't written her out of what she's able to do, which I think was a great decision.
And when I do the final book, I will do it with a loophole so that if I have to go back or decide to go back 2 or 3 years down the road, I could write another one without, having made the whole thing a dream sequence or something, I will leave an out.
Well, do you see yourself slowing down? Well, I mean, you've been relentless the entire time I've known you. You've never missed a deadline. You've put out a book, at least one book every year in side books. And now do you see maybe taking a little more time?
Well, my contract calls for a book a year. So I'm still trying to keep that pace. There's going to come a time. I have 6 grandkids. And I would love to be able to spend more. They came by today and said, Grancy, let's go take the puppy for a walk. Well, I had to stay at the computer and do interviews all day. So I'd like to be able to spend more time with the grands.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're retiring professionally, you could slow down. But, I've certainly met many writers over the years who, that's part of their contracts is to, take 18 months or slow it down or whatever. So, that might be a choice for you. If, on the other hand, you're so disciplined, I'm not at all sure you'd really be happy if you weren't working.
Well, that's it. When I turn in a manuscript for the next, a couple of weeks, I wake up in the morning and I think, well, what am I going to do now? What do I do today?
So. I know people are always asking me when I'm going to retire. And, I'm always saying, what would I do? I mean, what would I do that I'm not currently doing if I were retired? And so far, the answer hasn't yet occurred to me. Too bad.
A lot of people, when they retire, they write a book, so.
Or in my case, keep reading, right? However it goes. But anyway, anything else come in, Jacob?
Yeah, there was a question from Andrea. How much thought goes into tying the title to the plot?
Oh, titles. Sometimes the title is with me right from the beginning, like Deja Dead. I knew that's the title I wanted. It looked good on the cover. It had the double French-English play on, words. Sometimes we're getting down to the final, or I'm wrapping up the manuscript, and the publisher's saying, you got until Friday to come up with a title. Sometimes it's a compromise. We work it out together. The Bone Hacker, I think that came quickly. And I like that double meaning of that, the hacking off the hands as well as the cyber hacking. So did that answer the question? But I put a lot of thought into it. I want it to be clever. And I want it to be tied to the plot and have meaning to something that's going on in the plot. Like the next book, Fire and Bones. Guess how the book starts out? Big fire.
Right. Yeah. You know, I was looking back here. They had actually Bones, the first Bone title was Rare Bones, which was 2-4 book 6. And then you did one called Monday Morning. And then since then, I think all of the books have had Bones in the title.
And guess why? That's when the show went on the air, 2005.
Got it. And
the publisher wanted the Bones in the title. One of my favorite titles is Monday Morning, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G. And the book starts with a quote from the mamas and the papas, you know, Monday, Monday.
Right.
I liked that.
I did too. Actually, I like Desjardins. I also like Des du Jour. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, Montreal's a Francophile city. So, you know.
Yeah, I set the first book there and never thought about it. And later I was talking to someone and they said, really, you set it in Canada? My publisher made me move it. My story out of Canada, whereas Scribner was happy with that. They were delighted with that. And I tried to make it, I thought Montreal would be a little exotic mm-hmm. to North Americans and yet close enough to be comfortable to them. So I think
it's not difficult to visit Montreal at all.
I've had people say to me, I went up there and my husband and I did a whole Tempe tour. We went to all the places we read about, you know, in the books.
Well, you've gone to other, as you pointed out earlier in this conversation, you've gone to a lot of other really interesting locations. I have to say that the one that I have never, well, aside from Afghanistan, which I have not been to, I've never been to Turks and Caicos, which apparently is not all that difficult. So I have a feeling
it's a lot more pleasant than Afghanistan.
Yeah, but I mean, I have a feeling that a lot of people are going to be interested in reading it, you know, in part for that location, because I don't know. Even though it is a big tourist destination, I don't remember meeting many people who've actually been there. So, you know, maybe you're going to start an influx of.
Oh, no, I hope not.
I love it. Right. Well, thank you, Kathy. I know it's getting late. Well, so,
Kathy, do you have time just for a few more questions? We did have an influx of new ones.
That's up to Barbara.
Sure. It's up to you.
My fault. Yeah. Go ahead. For it.
This one is from Fred. Hi, Kathy. As a reader fan, has a reader or fan ever influenced you with an idea that actually turned into a book?
There may have been comments or ideas that were given to me from readers or fans that I used as a minor subplot, but not as a major theme of a book.
Derek
Good ideas.
Derek Good asks, any thoughts of Atlantic Canada book with
I did one, which was it? Bones to Ashes is set in New Brunswick and Nova Scotia. So yep, been there, done that. Bones to Ashes. I think that's the one.
All right. Those just came in last minute, so. That's it though.
All right.
Well, thank you, Kathy, for spending part of your evening with us. I'm sorry you had to give up grandchildren and puppy walking time, but maybe
puppies around here somewhere. So hopefully.
Yeah, right. Okay. Mine are currently locked up, so they weren't intruding on all this. Anyway, it's always great to see you. Thank you for this wonderful book, which was a joy to read. And we do still have some autographed copies left of The Bone Hacker. Which I recommend. Let me also say that you don't have to have read the first 21, rather.
Absolutely not. Every book is a self-contained story. So,
But I mean, you can dive into this one without having read any of the earlier ones. And then if you're hooked, you can go back. Because fortunately, they're all still in print, as far as I know. Which you can't say for every author. So I think that's a real tribute to the longevity and the popularity of the series. So thanks again for signing the books, Kathy, and spending time with us. Good night, everybody.
Good night. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.